Welcome to Expats and Allies, a show dedicated to exploring how and why Nazi war criminals found refuge in North America after the end of the Second World War. I'm your host, Alex Kosh, and I'm here, as always, joined by my two co-hosts, Sarah Rieger and Chuka Ejekam. How are you guys?
Good. Thanks, Alex.
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks.
So we're here with episode 4. This is actually the first recording that we're doing, having already launched the show and to the general public. We're really pleased about the reception we've had so far, although you'll all be listening to this several weeks down the line. So anything I'd be saying about the launch would be outdated at this point. So I won't dwell too much on that. In episode 3, the last episode we did, we looked at the case of aristofascism. That is specifically how British ruling class elites, the royal family, the aristocracy, not only had an affinity for fascist movements both at home and in Italy and the Nazis in Germany, but also in many cases actively aided and abetted and collaborated with those Nazi and fascist forces. And as we mentioned in the last episode, this is going to be a really key frame of analysis for this show because of how central the feature of anti-communism is in terms of understanding why Western countries after the war ended were so ready to accept Nazi war criminals and fascist collaborators into their country in the context of the Cold War against the Soviet Union, which came after the Second World War. So the general thesis of the last episode was that the British ruling class were so utterly concerned about the rise of communism and the workers' movements in Western Europe that essentially they saw fascism as an effective way to strike that down and to destroy it. This, of course, ended up persisting after the Second World War, but the last episode looked at really the build-up to the Second World War and their activities during the Second World War. And some of the unique dynamics we saw in the UK were kind of centered around its ancient feudalistic class structure. The UK has an aristocracy, it has a royal family, and those factors were really unique in terms of understanding the ruling class of that country and why they specifically found an affinity for fascism. So some of the key things we looked at were how, you know, the British ruling aristocracy were very worried about both the challenges of communism and the ascent of industrial capitalism as challenging their kind of ancient order. And they saw fascism as a very useful way to counter that and reinvigorate the significance of sort of traditionalist narratives around the monarchy and the aristocracy. In today's episode, we're heading over the Atlantic Ocean into a very different context. But nonetheless, we'll find that fascism still found willing collaborators and supporters in the ruling class of that country. This is, of course, the United States, where we're entering into a directly settler colonial context and the unique dynamics that will come to play in that type of state. So today, Chuka is going to be kind of leading the discussion, I guess, having done the research on this topic. So Chuka, could you perhaps start just by telling us, like, what is unique about the United States as we kind of launch into this conversation about the affinity of the ruling class in that country for fascism?
Yeah, well, I think in one regard, obviously the sort of structural racism that was employed and relied upon in the founding of the United States didn't originate in the United States. But I think the fact that it was prominent in the construction of the society and implemented internally through the construction of the society, I think that is a significant distinction, because it sort of creates circumstances in which those racially informed laws are imposed internally. And I think the connection, of course, to the rise of Nazism is, I think, evident in that, of course, they also deployed racially informed legal structures internally. Additionally, I think the particular influence that the United States had in the world post-World War II allows it to carry forward some of these impetuses in the way that it pursues its own position in terms of global dominance and asserting its interests in the world, which, you know, throughout the Cold War are dramatically expressed, I guess, in the U.S.'s sort of support for particular governments, interventions and things like that, all of which were intended to reduce the influence of communism in the world.
I'm interested to hear you dig into this one, Chuka, because I think the Americans have painted a real image of themselves, especially like with media and stuff, as just these Nazi punchers in World War II, you know? And I think people might be surprised to learn just how much support there was, like literal rallies being held in Madison Square Gardens in the late 1930s and things like that. So I think this will be a really informative one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's certainly it is in the American self-perception. They do present, there is this idea of them being this like the heroic country riding in on the horse at the end of the war to save everyone's lives. But I mean, there's a lot of reporting or research that shows that there wasn't significant support throughout the U.S. population for entering World War II, even after news of the Holocaust and the abuse and subjugation and oppression of Jewish people, or even after the increasingly harsh and increasingly racist laws employed against Jewish people within Nazi Germany, even as reporting that was more widespread and the oppression itself was becoming more overt, there still was neither widespread support among the American public or elected officials in the U.S. for entering the war, nor was there significant support for accepting Jewish refugees. Again, despite that, the news of the oppression and ultimately, of course, extermination of Jewish people as a kind of key aspect of Nazi policy, even as that was becoming more understood throughout the world, there still wasn't movement on this in the U.S.
It's probably a good lesson that anytime there's a historical narrative that's just like, well, we were the good guys, it might be worth taking a second to unpack that.
Yeah, so I figured I'd start off with a couple fun facts about the United States. And Alex and Sarah, I'm sure that you'll recognize these, but in case the listeners don't know. So the first one is, you know, it's something that we're all aware of because we came of age after 9/11 and whatnot. But I think it is notable that the United States is the only country in the history of the world to have ever operated a global unilateral kidnapping, torture, and assassination program. Now, it's not to say that there weren't other countries which would have liked to do that or which would have liked to have that power and impunity, but the United States pulled it off. There's effectively no limit to where drones can be deployed, where they can strike and murder people. The United States, of course, occupied Iraq and Afghanistan for two decades after World War II, or I'm sorry, after 9/11. But the also, you know, Guantanamo Bay, of course, the extreme egregious offenses of torture and solitary confinement, stress positions, all the horrific abuses that happened there. Those, of course, they're further evidence of the U.S.'s impunity, but even the existence of Guantanamo Bay, which is in Cuba. And, you know, for those who don't know, Cuba is not part of the United States. In fact, it's, you know, not viewed favorably within the U.S. establishment. Nonetheless, they have this, you know, this unregulated, effectively this, you know, black site in the country. And then, you know, the last thing is Osama bin Laden was killed in Pakistan, right? Not Afghanistan, not Iraq even. So like, you know, what's going on? I think it is quite notable how overt American power has been projected throughout the world, even though, you know, that's perhaps starting to unravel. And then the second thing is that in 2002, there was a law proposed and ultimately passed called the American Service Members Protection Act. This is colloquially known as the Hague Invasion Act. And this law compels the U.S. president to invade the Netherlands, to invade the International Criminal Court, if there are any American service members who are held there on charges of war crimes or crimes against humanity. This law also prohibits providing military aid to any countries that are party to the International Criminal Court. There are exceptions on that second part. If the country is deemed to be an ally or if it's a part of NATO, then, you know, they're allowed to provide them arms. I mean, but obviously it's incredibly selectively applied. And I think the fact that it was proposed and passed in 2002 is also, you know, rather telling. It seems like they knew what they were going to do and they wanted to get ahead of it. So, yeah, I mean, it's that I remember when I first learned about the Hague Invasion Act, it seems impossible, but no, it's real. It's real.
So two thoughts on this. First, your definition of fun fact is terrifying to me. And second, for listeners who maybe are listening to this and going, okay, but what does this have to do with fascism? You know, I assume you're getting here at two things, kind of like the militarism component of fascism and also just kind of the national overreach. That's a little bit terrifying. Can you maybe like spell that out for people who are like, what are the ties here? What are we getting into?
Well, I mean, these first two things are just a bit just like interesting details about the country. But I do think that the way that kind of any action, any violent action is deemed acceptable and even heroic if it's performed in the service of this, like in service of whatever this national idea is, right? Whether it be the war on terror or Manifest Destiny or what have you. I think that the idea that violent actions can be folded into this heroic struggle or heroic campaign or whatnot, I think that is quite evident in the modern construction of the U.S. military as it relates, of course, to the war on terror. And then the Hague Invasion Act, I think it just shows a contempt for international law that is, one, not only telling in regards to the U.S. establishment's views of, you know, multipolarity, diplomacy, things like that, but also, again, given that the International Criminal Court and international law were created in response to World War II in recognition of the horrors of the Holocaust, it's quite something if you refuse to sign up for the International Criminal Court. It's particularly when, as you mentioned, Sarah, the U.S. presents itself as such a heroic factor in World War II, but you know it won't sign up to the international structures meant to prevent that from happening again.
One other kind of thread I want to pick up on that is how in this kind of era of like, well, that is maybe coming to an end, but an era that we all certainly lived through of absolute American impunity, self-protection, self-preservation, and so forth on the world stage. In every conflict that the United States embroiled itself in, the leader of the opposing power or country is always characterized as quote-unquote like Hitler or like the Nazis. We saw it with Saddam Hussein. We saw it with Gaddafi. We now see it with Putin today. So I'm wondering if you could like speak to that a little bit about how, on the one hand, America kind of rejected in many ways the international law and humanitarian structures that came out after the war, but has nonetheless kind of weaponized the legacy of the Second World War to kind of shore up that impunity.
Yeah, I mean, I think this has something to do with, again, something that is perhaps falling out of fashion now, the international rules-based order, which gets, you know, spoken about a lot by Western leaders. But as has been noted more recently, particularly by South Africa's foreign minister, the international rules-based order, the rules aren't written anywhere, right? They weren't ever presented to anybody. They weren't ever, you know, voted on or validated by global consensus. So I think, one, despite that America, the United States sort of refuses to engage with international criminal law, international humanitarian law in ways that would allow itself to be subject to negative determinations, negative judgments based on those laws, it still nonetheless views itself as kind of an arbiter of global order, an arbiter of whatever structure powers in the U.S. deem to be best suited for keeping the world in order and keeping peace and things like that. I would say that rules-based order as constructed by the United States, then, you know, anybody who is an opponent to the U.S. is fundamentally equivalent to Hitler, because they, you know, if the U.S. is the determinant for global peace, if global peace and security relies upon the United States, then anybody who seeks to unseat its position of power or, you know, trouble it in any way, therefore necessarily has contempt for the international rules-based order, has contempt for peace and things like that. I think that those ideas kind of fold together well and support one another in interesting ways. So, you know, as we talked about in the last episode, and as you mentioned, Alex, a lot of the support for fascism, specifically Nazi fascism in the U.S., or in the Western world, in the years leading up to World War II in the UK, was about aristocracy. It was about class position and, seeing the communist revolution, not wanting that to happen, specter haunting Europe and so on. I think that one distinction A distinction between that case and the case of the United States is, I think the structures of racial supremacy in the founding of the United States are more immediately relevant than notions of class position. And I think even the way, notably, even the way class comes into this, comes into, even the way class plays into the support for Nazism and the support for fascism throughout American elites, it is still by way of race and religion. So I think, yeah, that's something interesting that we'll come to. But, you know, more than anything else, I would argue that the U.S. owes its existence to two particular historical events: the genocide of millions of indigenous peoples throughout the Americas, and you know, this was intentional. And you know, people who are listening to the show are likely to know this already, but there's still some who say, "Oh, well, you know, they just, you know, they hadn't encountered the diseases that Europeans had already built up resistances to, and things like that." No, it was intentional. One, not only was it intentional, but also contemporaries of Christopher Columbus, for example, remarked upon how brutally racist and violent he was. So it's not only that this massacre was purposeful, it's also that it, even at the time, it was deemed egregious and sort of exuberantly violent. So there really isn't any even, you know, defensive argument for it, let alone justification. And then, of course, there's also the 400 years of chattel enslavement of tens of millions of African peoples, entire successive generations both born into and died in enslavement and suffered inconceivable horrors in the time between. And, you know, you'll hear people say sometimes that, you know, slavery existed everywhere in the world. Elon Musk, noted idiot, Elon Musk recently said that, you know, everybody was a slave. It's just a question of when. I mean, that's, he certainly wouldn't be able to cite anything that defends that argument. But it, I think it is important to note that while it is true that slavery existed in many parts of the world and at many different times in history, this is not true of chattel enslavement, which is what occurred in the U.S. Chattel enslavement is a structure of slavery which relegates the enslaved person to a non-human category. So it is explicitly, it explicitly categorizes enslaved people as fundamentally genetically inferior. That is very different than other systems of slavery, which even if they're class-based or case-based, or even if it's people captured in war, the idea that the enslaved people are fundamentally genetically inferior and therefore enslavement is their rightful position, or even they are being upraised by the people who enslave them, that is novel. And the fact that it plays so strongly in American narratives about slavery, I think, is especially important as well. Also, it's worth noting that both of these events were justified by Christianity. The doctrine of discovery, as many people will know, and as indigenous peoples throughout the Americas have been campaigning against for decades now, claimed that all territories which were uninhabited by Europeans, i.e. Christians, could rightfully be taken from their existing inhabitants through whatever means was necessary, as doing so would ultimately be in service of God, right? You know, if you're devout, everything you do is in service of God in a sense. And so, and you know, people who were not Christian being brought to Christian, being brought to Christianity by whatever means, again, it was deemed as a gift to them, as opposed to a degradation of their culture, cultural genocide, and so on. Another aspect of this is that the country to which the settlers belonged, the settlers which, you know, took a particular piece of territory, the country to which they belonged, rightfully held those lands against claims from other European countries. So within this doctrine of discovery, it's only the claims, only the existence of European peoples and their claims to territory that is recognized. Everything else is effectively immaterial. And then there's Paul's letter to the Ephesians. Now, there are a number of discussions of slavery in the Bible, and I myself am not particularly well read on scripture, but it is true that both abolitionists and people and slavers themselves cited the Bible for their position. So it's not that the Bible is only pro-slavery or only against it, but certainly there are passages that they cited that supported it. For example, in Paul the Apostle's letter to the Ephesians, it is written, "Slaves, be obedient to your human masters with fear and trembling in sincerity of heart as to Christ." And, you know, there's a recent film starring Will Smith. I can't recall it at the time, but or I can't recall the name of it right now, but in the film, Will Smith plays an enslaved person, and someone explicitly says to him, you know, "Look upon me as you would look upon your Lord," things like that. So
I think that was Emancipation, the Will Smith film.
Yes. Yeah. And so thank you. And so in both cases, the like explicit racial supremacy and violently enforced racial supremacy were supported by, you know, religious doctrine or religious beliefs, and not just supported by, justified by, deemed saintly in a sense.
Maybe I'm barking up the wrong tree a bit here, but do you see any connection between the kind of the concept of like terra nullius, the kind of doctrine of discovery, and the kind of Nazi concept of Lebensraum, which was obviously one of the driving narratives of, I think that was the specific justification for Operation Barbarossa, which was the Eastern Front. Do you see a connection between these two?
Absolutely. And not primarily myself. Adolf Hitler saw a connection between those things. And he spoke about the creation of the United States as a model for the creation of the thousand-year Reich that he saw Germany becoming. He spoke quite positively about the United States in a number of instances. And there were also prominent people in the US who wrote very favorably about the Nazi regime up to and into the years of World War II, for these same reasons, for its, you know, explicit racial hierarchy, its ideas about racial purity being fundamental to the country, its willingness to expel or eliminate particular groups. I absolutely think there's, not just incidentally, there's meaningful connections here that the Nazis were aware of. We'll come to this in a bit, but there, like, it wasn't even just Hitler. Nazi lawyers, jurists, and doctors spoke very, very favorably of U.S. Legislation in the South, the Jim Crow laws and whatnot, and anti-miscegenation laws as well.
The thing that really, I don't know, sticks out to me as you're talking about this is just how much the U.S. has really refined these concepts and like the quest for economic power, and especially like the amassing of private wealth, like whether it's dating back to slavery or just even the idea of we need more land, we need more wealth for our nation, and just kind of how intricately like those two concepts are linked, and probably, you know, why these roots of fascism in America are so deep.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, I haven't done too much reading on this, and so I don't entirely understand how it happened. But in my research for this episode, I found that as economists were developing the notion of the free economy or of a free market, they were analyzing economic occurrences or dynamics based on an economy that had an immense amount of unpaid labor. And so it's not only that those human beings are not considered as people or sort of being worthy of any kind of recognition or anything like that, but it's also that their labor is sort of factored into the system without mention. You know, it's kind of just a fundamental force in the world that these people will be providing this labor without compensation, that they will be enslaved. I think the way that the U.S. refined these concepts and the way they were so structural in many aspects of America's rise to dominance in the world for the period that it has been dominant, I think that is in part because they were so prevalent in the foundation of the country. You know, these ideas obviously didn't originate in the United States. They came out of Europe. But I as you said, Alex, I think their expression, or sorry, as you said, Sarah, I think their expression in the U.S., did allow for them to develop further and further.
Just as you were talking, it reminded me of this book I'm working my way through right now called Nazi Billionaires by Bloomberg reporter David DeJohn. And he really talks about all of these German corporations and kind of like their long roots in some of these ideas and then how they actually were able to like harness that into wealth during the Nazi regime. And it just makes me think so much of American corporatism too and some of the ideals behind it. There was this meeting that Hitler had with a bunch of like wealthy CEOs and stuff when he was like raising money to run, essentially. Where's the quote here? He said, "Private enterprise cannot be maintained in the age of democracy." And I think like the book doesn't really touch on America a lot, but I think that's just so interesting to think of in the context of, you know, the values of white supremacy and stuff that it sounds like you're going to dive into here and the motives behind that.
Mm-hmm. I didn't get a ton of research on this, but there were a number of U.S. corporations that not only did business with Nazi Germany. Standard Oil, I believe, is one of the companies that built a lot of refineries in Germany after Hitler had come to power. But it's also the case that, you know, even during World War II, even in the years right before it, there were like the Nazi regime still had connections to, law firms operating in New York City, for example. I think one of the Dulles brothers, I think Alan Dulles did so. I think John Foster Dulles worked in a law firm that did business with the Nazis prior to World War II or in the first years, but I can't remember the exact details. But for those who don't know, John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles were two brothers who were part of the US kind of intelligence community prior to the intelligence community really existing. They came out of the OSS. Anyway, yeah, so they were very prominent. John Foster Dulles was the Secretary of State at one point. Alan Dulles was the director of the CIA at one point. I can't remember if it was Alan Dulles or John Foster Dulles, but one of them, their wife described them as a shark, like dead-eyed and murderous, I guess. So I don't know. I don't know why you would stay married to that person, but I'm not sure that they had a choice given the time. So I think one another thing that's especially important in this discussion is the history of eugenics in the United States. As is with a great many of the world's ills, eugenics is a formal field or discipline that first emerged in Britain. Sir Francis Galton, a British scholar who was described as a polymath and who made contributions to the field of statistics and many other fields, originally sort of coined the term in 1883 and began kind of, intellectual, quote unquote, discourse about this notion, the notion that you could, through sort of control of reproduction, you could improve the quality effectively of a population, of a race or whatnot, by discouraging the reproduction of undesirables, I guess, and encouraging the reproduction of desirables. So we talked a bit about this man in the last episode, but in 1910, Winston Churchill was honorary vice president of the Eugenics Education Society in the UK, and he spoke of the quote, the danger to the race posed by the multiplication of the unfit. Contemporarily in the US, J.H. Kellogg, so John H. John, yeah, H. Kellogg, yes, that Kellogg, he founded
Cereal
the,
Kellogg, Cornflake Kellogg. Oh boy.
yes, exactly, yeah, the inventor of. So he founded the Race Betterment Foundation in Michigan in 1906. And in 1911, Charles Davenport, another prominent American eugenicist, founded the Eugenic Records Office in New York City. And a man named Harry McLaughlin, or Harry H. Laughlin, served as the superintendent of the Eugenic Records Office in New York City from its founding in 1911 to its closing in 1939. Harry H. Laughlin was also editor of the Eugenical News. Great name, really rolls off the tongue. Which he wrote frequently both about not just like the values of eugenics, but he wrote frequently about the Nazis in that paper and like extolling the virtues of the policies that they were implementing. There's a documentary by Ken Burns released, I believe, last year called The US and the Holocaust, which has a lot of great information about this period and names a lot of the people who were prominent and the relations that they had, but also has a lot of really interesting factual information about the period. For example, and I don't think this is a coincidence, but at the turn of the century, around 1900, evidently 25% of the population of New York City was Jewish. Now, a normal person would hear that and think that's just like an interesting historical fact, and it gives some information about the cultural mosaic that is New York City and the kind of one of the found the Jewish people holding one of the kind of critical foundational places in that cultural mosaic. But Christian eugenicist freaks were terrified by that, and I think also had a racial or it had like a political element in the sort of its racial constructions. Obviously, obviously Nazi Germany spoke a lot about Judeo-Bolshevism, or the international Jew and whatnot. An idea that Jewish people were nefarious because they held no allegiance to any state or any people other than themselves. They were sort of inherently invaders and usurpers, a foreign element within your country. And so the fact of that level of population, that number of Jewish people in New York City, eugenicists would have seen that as a political issue itself, in addition to, the sort of biological, quote unquote, aspects of eugenics.
So I'm not sure of my timeline here. So correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like these early roots of like fervor, I guess, around eugenics were kind of like starting even more in the US and stronger, like earlier than they even were in Germany. Is that right?
Absolutely, yes. From my research, I found that the first eugenics law, the first explicit eugenics law passed in Germany was passed in 1933 after Hitler had come to power. And this was a law regarding the, quote, heredity of future generations. So this was it did allow for forcible sterilization, but it was based on this model law written by Harry Laughlin in the U.S. And that law in the U.S. was upheld at the federal Supreme Court in 1927. So, eventually, I believe 33 states had legislation either allowing for or mandating forced sterilization for specific peoples. So it absolutely was more widespread in the U.S. at the time than in Germany. And it kind of flourished in a sense in the United States. It was extremely popular and widespread.
Very, very America first of them.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, that is the thing. Harry Laughlin, evidently he wrote sometimes that he was like his writing seemed to express a kind of envy of what was happening in Nazi Germany, sort of a wish that sort of explicitly violent racial hierarchy was throughout the United States as opposed to just, you know, in the South, in the Jim Crow South.
And also when I say America first, I want to be, I don't know, I feel like I'm maybe being a bit too tongue in cheek. Maybe you'll get to this later on. So apologies if I'm doubling up, but Charles Lindbergh in the 30s was holding America first rallies to basically rally support, you know, against America entering World War II and, you know, with quite anti-Semitic slogans saying, you know, we don't want the Jews to drag us into this war. And you think about him, this American aviator, this hero, and, you know, while he wasn't outright supporting the Nazis, his America first slogan was really calling for that America first in a very like white supremacist sort of way. And obviously that's a slogan that we've now heard Donald Trump pick up in his last election.
No, I appreciate you mentioning that. I probably don't have as much information about Lindbergh as I should, but yeah, it seems that initially he was just talking about, you know, we don't want to get into another war, you know, it's the European issue, but as time went on, he more explicitly began to like echo the statements of the Nazi regime. I believe FDR also like took issue with him. I think in this documentary that I watched, he related privately to someone that he was certain that Lindbergh was an anti-Semite, but he, you know, couldn't say so publicly. But, you know, Lindbergh was kind of positioned against FDR's, you know, sort of in the beginning, I think somewhat muted desire for America to join the effort against the Nazis. I think, you know, historical record seems to demonstrate that FDR held that position long before it was widespread among the American public, long before Pearl Harbor, but didn't very strongly advocate for it until he felt it had more support.
Well, and from what I remember, some of the protests against FDR at the time, talking about the New Deal, I hate to even repeat this phrasing, but the protesters called it the Jew Deal. Like, that's the level of anti-Semitism that was happening at the time. FDR was Episcopalian. It had nothing to do with it, but it was totally just this fear-mongering and hate that was being drummed up, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, that title for it, that is quite something. I hadn't heard of that until I was doing research for this episode. And again, I think it goes back to the idea that anything, any notion of communality, right? Any notion of like a collective common purpose, shared circumstance was, you know, deemed necessarily a product of nefarious Jewish influence.
Just coming back to this larger thread of eugenics, I wonder if you can kind of connect the dots for us a little bit here, going from the context of like the settler colonial genocide that took place to occupy the land and the specific circumstances of slavery. Do these two things kind of drive the appeal of eugenics among the ruling class in America, do you think?
I think that it made them very amenable. I don't know. I imagine that for a lot of these people, they were forward facing, right? Like they weren't thinking, oh, you know, eugenics justifies all these things that happened in the past because, you know, those people are genetically inferior. I think it was, it seems to me that a lot of it had to do with concerns about immigration and justifying, like creating reasons or justifications for not allowing immigrants from various parts of the world. Laughlin, for example, spoke about Eastern and Southern European peoples as being, you know, of a lower character, of a more polluted gene pool or whatever. And Jewish people as well, specifically, and wanted to prohibit them from entry, using the argument that they would, you know, pollute the gene pool or lower the racial quality of the United States or whatever. And so I think it was in part sort of informed by the impetus of those events, like the notion that peoples can be enslaved without any moral quandary, or people can be exterminated without any moral quandary. And then wanting to create and uphold a specific like racial composition, population within the country, and wanting to do so on grounds that weren't merely like base discrimination, right? Not just, well, I don't like those people, and I don't like the food they eat, I don't like the way they dress, but more so, we are doing this for the betterment of humanity, because, you know, over time we will create a more elite species or something.
And that's really connected to that Christian nationalism you were talking about as well too, right?
I think so, yeah. The notion of the you know, quote unquote, white man's burden, I think there is an implicit religious or religiously understood obligation, right? This notion that you are acting in service of God by seeking to upraise these low peoples and, you know, show them the light of Jesus Christ and things like that. And I think this will become even more relevant later on in our discussion, but the notion that if you are, you know, living in the light of Jesus Christ, then the material conditions of your life don't matter. Because that fact itself, that you are, you know, experiencing God's love or what have you, that means that no matter what your material situation, you are living a good life. So an enslaved person who, you know, is forced to repeat religious phrases, repeat Christian phrases, or like attend a Christian church service, they would be seen as being gifted not just, you know, the light of God's love, but also eternal life, you know, after their death, after the fact, regardless of what their experience on earth is. I do think they end up supporting one another. Again, eugenics was widespread in the US. It was taught in universities, it was espoused by medical societies, it was preached by clergy. John D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, Margaret Sanger, and Alexander Graham Bell, and even Helen Keller were all prominent supporters of eugenics. Helen Keller wrote about the, quote, malformed idiot baby, and the sort of determinations that could be made based on that. And then Theodore Roosevelt, I don't know, renowned woodsman or what have you, wrote at one point, quote, "I wish very much that the wrong people could be prevented entirely from breeding. And when the evil nature of these people is sufficiently flagrant, this should be done. Criminals should be sterilized and feeble-minded persons forbidden to leave offspring behind them."
That is such a horrifying and hateful statement. But I also want to rewind slightly back to something you just said, which is, I heard Alexander Graham Bell's name. He's one of those people that Canadians love to cite as one of ours.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a lot of those people at the time. One, it does seem that, you know, anti-Semitism was incredibly widespread. So a lot of prominent people would have been anti-Semites. But yeah, this is like, you know, these were people who were funding it, who were promoting it, effectively proselytizing for it. And so I think it is notable, yeah, that there's so many people who are considered captains of industry or crucial inventors or what have you that held these beliefs openly and sought to propagate them. And then one more note is that in the late 1930s, as Nazi persecution of the Jewish people became more and more overt and more widely known, a bill was proposed in Congress to accept 20,000 Jewish refugees, mostly children. There was a group of anti-Semites, Laughlin among them, who lobbied and worked to have this bill defeated, and they were successful. And it was understood, or you know, again, from the information I saw, researchers have found that the Nazis took other countries' refusal to accept Jewish refugees as vindication of their beliefs. And I think it's notable and important to note that right now the Israeli government is doing the same thing with Palestinians. They're saying, well, nobody else wants them, so clearly they're awful, so what we're doing is justified. Regarding how Hitler viewed the United States, both in terms of eugenics policies and racially stratified society. So I'm going to read a couple of quotes from an article written in Dissent magazine by Omer Aziz. There are, just a couple passages that I think are really interesting, and I figured it would be nice to just read it directly rather than trying to paraphrase. So the first, on June 5th, 1934, Nazi lawyers, jurists, and medical doctors gathered under the auspices of Justice Minister Franz Gertner to discuss how to codify the Prussian memorandum. The first item discussed was U.S. law. Quote, almost all the American states have race legislation, Gertner averred, before detailing a myriad of examples, including the many states that criminalized mixed marriages. Roland Freisler, the murderous Nazi judge, stated at the meeting that U.S. jurisprudence would suit us perfectly. All the participants displayed either an eager interest in or an avowed knowledge of U.S. law. This went beyond specific legislation. The Nazis looked to an innovative legal culture that found ways to relegate Native Americans, African Americans, immigrants, Chinese, Japanese, Filipinos, and others to second and third class status. The many devious pathways around the constitutional guarantees of equal protection, the deliberate textual ambiguity on the definition of race itself, the draconian penalties for sexually consorting with a lesser race, or even meeting publicly. The United States in the 1930s was the apogee of a racist state.
Wow, that one bit you said about just the innovative legal culture really hits, hey? Like, it just shows how systemic these policies were of discrimination. Just wild.
Yeah, and I think it's, there were even some instances in which the Nazis found American laws to be overly harsh, I don't know if they found them to be overly harsh, but they didn't equal their harshness. For example, I don't know exactly how the Nazis brought up or broke out their, who counts as a Jew chart. But I understand that it had to do with, what number of your grandparents or great grandparents or what have you. Whereas in the United States, it was deemed that if you had one drop of black blood, then you were deemed black. This is still in many ways an informal system that we use, where, a mixed race person is regarded as black before they're regarded as mixed race and things like that. But that one drop was more overt than Nazi classifications of race. It is quite telling. And they were, I think it's also notable that they were drawing instruction from those examples. It wasn't just that they were praising them. They were also specifically looking at the U.S. and seeking to adopt its policies and adopt its stratification.
And what are some of the legislations that we're talking about here? You just mentioned racial classification, but I assume we're also talking about stuff like housing segregation policies, employment discrimination, stuff like that too, right?
Yeah, I think all manner of discrimination throughout society would have been justified by this, whether it's, barring people from living in certain areas, barring them from working in certain places, barring them from membership in unions or things like that, or of course, the universal right to refuse service to people of, whatever racial group is deemed undesirable. But also, I think there's two things in particular. One, anti-miscegenation laws, so laws that prohibit relationships between people of different races. And then the ideas about race and racial purity were expressed through active eugenics. So, in the U.S., there had been discussion of euthanasia, of just ending the lives of babies and newborns who were deemed to be to not contribute to the gene pool or what have you. But ultimately, that was thought to be too much, I guess, of a moral burden to the person who had to do it. And so they went with forced sterilization instead to, prohibit people from from procreating. And, the numbers on this for the early part of the 20th century aren't are more difficult to find. But it is noted that during the Nixon administration, you know, well after World War II, there were, I believe, 400,000 people in the United States who were forcibly sterilized. And this was, they used the funding for the war on poverty. There was a specific, specific allowances for the money in the war on poverty program to be used for surgery, which would remove, disenable people from procreating.
Wow. The scale of this and just the, like, I guess, systemic, I don't know, power of it is really horrific and hard to think about.
Yeah. I mean, so while they cut the program dramatically, I think they reduced the funding 50%, and then they encouraged states to use a lot of the funding to just prohibit people from procreating. And Nixon himself said, like, explicitly, you know, we shouldn't let certain people procreate. And it was amazingly, it was also only for poor people. Like the using the war on poverty funding to sterilize people is only for poor people. So, you know, they know exactly what they're doing. I also actually forgot to mention that, you know, Harry Laughlin's work was so well regarded in Nazi Germany that he was awarded an honorary degree from Heidelberg University in 1936 for research on purifying the germplasm of the human population. I did not know the word germplasm, but So yeah, like there was a mutual relationship, and they were, you know, American eugenicists were aware of the expression of eugenics policies in Nazi Germany, and they applauded it. Okay, and I have one more passage from this Dissent magazine article. Hitler was not influenced by the United States alone. Let's learn from the English, Hitler said repeatedly, who, with 250,000 men in all, including 50,000 soldiers, governed 400 million Indians. As far as racially inspired lawmaking was concerned, it was the United States that aroused the Führer's interest the most, even as he deplored its liberal egalitarian ethos. He loved the novels of Karl May that depicted cowboys conquering the West, and, as Timothy Snyder and others have argued, Hitler's model for creating German Lebensraum in Europe was the American genocide of indigenous peoples, the depopulation of their lands, and their subsequent legal subjugation and ghettoization. Nazi intellectuals and doctors had a sustained engagement with the eugenics movement, which was codified into U.S. immigration law and served as a model for the Third Reich's own sterilization and euthanasia program. And yeah, a lot of these laws persisted, again, well after World War II. I saw one note that I wasn't able to verify this exactly, but I saw one note that said that the final law allowing for sterilization in the United States was repealed in 2014. So again, I wasn't able to verify it, but certainly these laws persisted throughout the 70s and 80s and beyond. And it's worth noting there wasn't a federal law for forced sterilization, but there were a lot of state laws. And it was, again, it was upheld by the Supreme Court.
I just want to say, I swear I didn't read that quote about the link between Lebensraum and the colonization of the United States, but that is extraordinary. And some of those connections are just so extensive, right down to, you know, Hitler's admiration for the kind of cultural depiction of imperialist conquest and settler colonialism through the kind of image of the cowboy. That's really quite profound. There's really not much one can think of that's more iconically American than a cowboy. And the fact that Hitler had such an affinity for it, I think, is just so telling.
And it is interesting, again, as we were talking about before, how America has managed to, or like Western society, but the US in particular as well, has managed to construct the Nazis as a unique evil to have, you know, the most overt evil to have ever existed in the world, and to construct themselves as the antithesis of that, despite that, you know, Hitler was like, oh yeah, the US, UK, those are my boys. Like, I love that shit. Like, it's something else.
The quote about Hitler kind of having this admiration for minority rule, a relatively small number of British people successfully occupying and imprisoning a vastly larger population was really quite striking to me as well. Really speaks to all these other iterations of imperial rule that we see in that we saw in apartheid South Africa, for example, as well. I'm really struck by so many of those quotes and just how much they say. It's quite profound, I think.
It's disturbing to hear the pieces of those quotes that are still so relevant in America today as well. You know, we're hearing these like really founding principles of a lot of the US's systems and Hitler openly praising them. And there's still stuff that we can see going on, you know, like the marginalization of like indigenous peoples in the US today.
I think as well, our discourses about immigration still reflect a lot of this. I know the C.D. Howe Institute is right now promoting some report that's arguing for quality over quantity in immigration. And like, what do you, you know, how are you, if you're talking about people and you use the term quality, you are necessarily making some kind of stratified judgment of the value that people hold, as opposed to recognizing the inherently infinite value of everybody except for fascists.
No, it's blatantly xenophobic, and it's wild to see just how identically it really parallels.
One of the last things that I wanted to talk about is American evangelicalism and the US military. And this is certainly more contemporary than World War II, but I think it is really important because it folds together the militarism, the notion of like a chosen people, a people in the image of the Lord and what have you, and then justifying any action to bring about a desired end. But also how it impacts very material circumstances and how it's expressed in U.S. policy, particularly in foreign policy and through the military. I think is, you know, very interesting and pretty concerning. So there's a series that's being published by Al Jazeera right now called Praying for Armageddon. There have been two episodes published, maybe a third was published today. It's free. It's free to watch. You can find it on YouTube. And it is about the evangelical movement, Christian Zionists in particular, and their beliefs about the world and how they seek to pursue those beliefs. So a central tenet of evangelical belief is that every word of the Christian Bible is literally true. This includes the apocalypse and the return of Jesus Christ as described in the book of Revelations. That is, clad in a blood-stained white gown, riding a white horse, and bearing a sword. Evangelicals see this as literal prophecy. Now, I'm not religious. No hate to anybody who is. But even if I were, it would be difficult for me to imagine believing this literally, right? Like literally believing that there will be a rapture, that Jesus will come back, that all the enemies of God will be slain, that Jews will be allowed, you know, Jews will either convert to Christianity or also be slain. I think it's also notable that, you know, when people colloquially talk about that and they mention, you know, Jews will have the chance to convert or they'll be killed, Muslims, you know, the third people of the book, as they're called, Muslims are never mentioned. And I assume this is because they don't get the chance to convert. They're just like automatically slain, I imagine. But the American evangelical Christians, they see the U.S. military as a vehicle through which to hasten Armageddon. And within these beliefs, most critically within these beliefs, is the state of Israel for sort of two reasons. One, that the state of Israel's control of Jerusalem is seen as a mandatory precursor to the return of Christ. Christian Zionists and Zionists overall refer to Jerusalem as the city of David. And there's something called the City of David Project, which is seeking to justify the dispossession of Palestinian peoples, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, seeks to justify it through what I would call fraudulent archaeology. But, you know, they'll like try to find religious or historical artifacts that demonstrate that the Bible is real and that, you know, the land belongs to the Jewish people and things like that.
I see some really interesting parallels here, just in kind of this like fascist courting of Christianity without inherently being a Christian movement that's happening today as well. Like Hitler wasn't a Christian. He said, I believe in 1928, our movement is Christian. And he really courted churches because he saw how much power they held, both like financially and societally. And so you could see that, how that would really like be in line with this like American stuff too. And it just makes me think of, you know, a leader today who has been described as fascist, Trump, who, you know, is maybe in many ways not aligned with Christian values, but yet really courts an evangelical base because he sees these kind of like ideological through lines between these fascist populist ideas and the tenets of their community.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is interesting about that is, you know, some will say a person need not be godly to act in God's or to act in God's service. You know, like God can make you know, saviors out of sinners or whatever. But other people will say it just doesn't matter. Like the only thing that matters is making the apocalypse happen. However we get there, we're just going to do what we need to do. So if we need like this obviously, I mean, again, you know, I don't buy into the notions of sin, but if we need this obviously sinful person from their perspective to be president, that's what we need. It doesn't really matter, you know?
Yeah, and even just looking back at Hitler, you know, Catholics were persecuted by him. But yeah, and we see these ideas of fascism, of who is without sin and who is worthy. It's interesting to see how these concepts are kind of like twisted to further these goals.
The relationship between Christianity and the American military is, I think, notable for a number of reasons, but particularly because of how it has kind of combined like very imperialist foreign policy with this, you know, I would say detached from reality religious doctrine that, you know, seemingly work together incredibly well, in ways that are alarming. So again, talking about the support for Israel among evangelical Christians, they believe, so again, it's not just that Israel must control the city of David, the historical city of David, i.e. Jerusalem. It's also that they believe the heralding event of Armageddon will be a great war in that region in which Israel comes under siege from the Antichrist. And I think that's notable for a number of reasons, but most specifically, it means that this group of people, ostensibly numbers about 80 million in the US, so roughly a quarter of the voting population, this group of people sees war, increasingly violent war, increasing numbers of climate-related disasters, really any instance of mass death or suffering, they see that as a good thing, right? They believe that it is an indicator that Armageddon is closer. And so they celebrate it explicitly. Like there's this guy we'll talk about a bit later, Robert Jeffers, who's really prominent now among evangelical Christians. He you know speaks at the rallies, or yeah, he speaks at their meetings. He's has relationships with Donald Trump. He specifically says the end of the world is nothing to fear. So you know it's really explicit. It's really explicit, and it's very they're very serious about it.
Do they see, I guess, do they see nuclear weapons as a kind of the means by which this Armageddon is going to occur? Like that would seem like the most obvious, I guess, method. Yeah, I'm just curious. Like, or do they think it's going to be, I don't know, laser beams from the heavens just blowing everything up? Like, I'm just curious as to like, what do they see as the way in which this happens?
They do well. You know, I can speak for this guy, but from what I gather is that they do see it as it will be, you know, weapons that we have that take the place of particular images or events in biblical prophecy. For example, this Jeffers guy again, in one interview, he says, he says, like, how would a disciple or how would someone from that time, John, I think he says, how would they describe an Apache helicopter or a nuclear explosion? They would describe it through appearance, right? And so, and he says that doesn't make these things less true. In fact, it makes them more true. There's another individual whose interview or whose appears in that Al Jazeera documentary series, who says that he believes the sword that Jesus will be carrying when he returns is an AR-15. And he's 100% serious, right? Like it's, I yeah, it's something else. You know, I it's difficult to understand how people end up there, although of course it's just, you know, the circumstances they're born into and their community around them and whatnot.
There's another thing that strikes me in terms of the connection of this to fascism is really the kind of fundamental nihilism that is at the heart of it. Like just this kind of, although Christian Zionists and evangelicals derive meaning or semblance of meaning of all this destruction from a relationship to God, in terms of its earthly implications, it is still absolute bloodshed and annihilation in much the same way that like nihilism was just such a key part of you know the kind of Nazi mentality of Vernichtung, like annihilation. You know, it's there's something very, very disturbingly similar between those two things, I think.
Yeah, it's peculiar in that it sort of perfectly folds together without issue. The notion that there is this like chosen people, these chosen nations that are representative of God's will and that act in service of God's will. But at the same time, nothing that happens on earth matters. And like ultimately, the only thing that matters is the rapture. And whether or not how you treat other people is completely separate from your kind of status as a person who will survive the rapture or not, right? It's only about your internally held religious ideation and has nothing to do with how your actions impact other people. It is quite something. I'll name a couple of the major figures in this and then provide a couple examples of how it appears in the world. Two of the main figures are Pastor John Hagee. He created the organization Christians United for Israel. It's the largest Christian Zionist organization in the U.S. And John Hagee's a real piece of work. Just as an example, he once said that Hurricane Katrina was God punishing New Orleans for its sinful ways, and in particular for homosexuality. And, he said there was a festival that was supposed to happen and obviously didn't after the hurricane hit. And he said, well, you know, the festival didn't happen. So, I guess that was God's will. So a real sicko. And then this guy, Dr. Robert Jeffers, this guy's on the news a lot now. He's a strange one. In an interview, he said, the Bible does teach in Revelation 16 and 19 that there's a final world battle that will take place. The ultimate enemy is going to be all those who reject Christ as Savior. And then later on in that interview, he says, once you understand the prophecies in Scripture, the end of the world is nothing to fear.
So, Chukwu, you set us up at the start with your not so fun facts about, these concepts of American imperialism and militarism and evangelism, and how they're going to kind of tie into fascism. Can you tell me just about, I guess, like the predominance of these ideas and how you see them relating to this topic?
One, like the way that this religious doctrine specifically kind of takes up the military and uses it as a vehicle, I think is one notable aspect of what I would characterize as like the American form of fascism, in sense, like the sort of fiercely religious influence in these ostensibly secular institutions, and particularly the pursuit of violence as like an act of religious fervor, I think is notable again in the American context. But also the specific ways that this appears, again, related to American foreign policy, is quite jarring. So there, in this documentary series, there's an individual there are two people in particular. One of them, the name escapes me, but the other is Colonel Larry Wilkerson, who is a former chief of staff for Colin Powell. He ultimately left the U.S. military and has taken cases from service people who have felt discriminated against or ostracized or harassed because they were effectively insufficiently religious. Many of them were Christian, but they weren't Christian enough, or things that they were asked to do were justified. The things that they were asked to do were presented through Christianity by religious leaders within the army. There are a lot of chaplains now in the U.S. military, and it is a specific project of the Christian right or the evangelical right to create new evangelicals through military training. Like they are brought in during basic training. They're preachers brought in during basic training toward the end, when they always say basic training, military training, is about breaking you down so you can be built up again. So they're brought in at the end of the breaking down stage, and they seek to build people up as evangelical Christians. Like hundreds of thousands of new recruits are put through these evangelical seminars or these evangelical teachings. And of course, there is as well the George W. Bush, who said that like God told him to do the war on terror, which, I mean, George, like if God exists, George W. Bush himself is already kind of a sick joke. So, maybe, but I don't know. So again, the relationship between the evangelical right and the U.S. military, I think, is in one, the construction of violence as an act of religious fervor or an act of observance of religion, but then also kind of the material ways that this is expressed. So one example that struck me was relayed in that documentary series, where there were 138 U.S. Marines who had been deployed in Helmand Province in Afghanistan, and they reported distress at this occurrence, because they were observing that they were walking into villages and, you know, seeking, you know, terrorists or whatever. And the village elders there, they didn't know about 9/11. They hadn't heard of it, but they had heard of what was called the Jesus gun. And so there was, during the war on terror, there was this U.S. company in the Midwest, I can't remember exactly what state, but they got a $2 billion contract to produce rifle scopes. And in every single scope that they produced, they burned in a Bible citation, a New Testament citation. This, of course, was not part of the contract, but the person who relays the story in the documentary series, he says, now just imagine the optics of American soldiers killing Arab Muslims with guns, with crosses and Bible citations burned into them. You know, it's even though like that war, that, you know, project, whatever you want to call it, wasn't explicitly racial, it was, of course, heavily racialized, right? People will still talk about, you know, the Middle East as a dangerous part of the world, or, you know, a rough neighborhood. And that, of course, has nothing to do. They're not in, when they say that, they're not referencing the decades of interference and intervention and usurpation and meddling of Western countries. They're just saying, oh, you know, Arabs are also violent. And so, yeah, I think the sort of particular way that every effort by the, or every deployment or intervention by the American military ends up being kind of folded into this larger religious project by the evangelical right is notable. And then in particular, especially right now, like the genocide that Israel is carrying out in Palestine, it would be safe to suspect that evangelical Christians celebrate it, right? They believe that it is good because a great war would mean the apocalypse is coming. So I'm just, like, if Israel were to attack Iran with a nuclear weapon, they would celebrate that, right? And I think that is something that is unique, I would say, in like the American conception of fascism or the American construction of fascism. Not just that violence is this noble, violence can be a noble act, or violence can be a self-actualizing act, but also that all of this violence can be deployed in pursuit of this final event, right? And that anything, really anything, is justified. Not just justified, everything is. Every sort of calamity, every disaster, every war is good in that it signals the return of Jesus Christ, or the coming return of Jesus Christ. Now, like, again, so you mentioned Hitler himself was not religious, and you know, the Nazis, I'm sure there were crosses in certain places, but obviously, like, the death's head is perhaps one of the most noted like Nazi symbols outside of the, of course, the swastika and the various military units, the insignia that they used. But yeah, in this instance, like, this is, you know, this is evangelicals believe that they're fighting a war for God, and that the war is necessary. Like, they're agitating to further it and to increase it. And they, again, they have a significant amount of influence in the American political system. So, I mean, I would characterize the evangelical right in the U.S. as by far the most violent and dangerous religious cult in the world.
Yeah, I also just want to kind of, like, I think what you've outlined here really kind of highlights this this fact that there's not really an inherent contradiction between certain Christians and certain sects of Christianity and fascism and Nazism. If we can cast our mind back to Jaroslav Hunker, the Waffen-SS veteran who was honored in Parliament back in September, the blog post which kind of revealed him, in which he kind of outed himself as a veteran of the SS Galicia Division. The leading sentence was, "My generation was united by two forces, faith in God and love for Ukraine." Sure, like I'm sure there were many Nazis who were not Christians, but the fact that these two things are inherently contradictory, I think, just kind of falls apart the faintest scrutiny. And if I can just steer us towards some kind of concluding remarks here, Truco, I think like what you've outlined here, what it's really elucidated for me is the fact that like there are constant iterations of this kind of nihilistic, destructive, right-wing nationalism that is not unique to Nazism. This trend preceded Nazism through, you know, settler colonial conquest, through slavery, through eugenics. It flowed through Nazism and overt support for fascism, and it lived long afterwards to the present day in this form that we see in kind of the kind of Christian nationalist movement and evangelicalism, essentially calling for the same things, operating on the same fundamental principles, albeit with different names, different vehicles, and different political movements that are kind of bearing the torch of this extremely scary and nihilistic movement.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that this, I think it is notable that the policies that the Nazis praised in the United States persisted after World War II. There, and you know, this was like a point of sort of international criticism, right? People would say, or the Nazi people in supporting Nazi Germany would say, oh, well, you know, the U.S. South laws in the U.S. South aren't all that much different, and that criticism was not considered meaningful enough to like cause any kind of consternation within the U.S. Right? There wasn't. Like even in the rejection of Nazism, even as that did occur in the United States, there was still an adherence to racial supremacy that superseded that. You can find stories about Black soldiers in World War II, Black American soldiers in World War II, who all had to sit alone separately and eat together, even when captured Nazi prisoners of war would sit with and eat with the American soldiers. They were treated better on trains. That would be the same thing. Captured Nazis would sit in front of Black soldiers. So there was still, even you know, within that system, even that it's ostensibly against this this sort of brutally imposed racial hierarchy, the United States still held to its own explicit racial hierarchy. And, you know, it still does today in many ways. And, you know, a lot of the arguments, I think, that we hear in politics, they do echo eugenics. I think, you know, people will still openly say, oh, you know, poor people shouldn't have kids. If you can't provide for a kid, you shouldn't have it. You know, discussions of immigration are still very much about, I mean, that, you know, it's more coded about like who has applicable skills and things like that. But it is, you know, largely about there are certain people who contribute and there are certain people who don't. And we don't want the people who don't.
What this really highlights is kind of just the false narrative I was told about World War II and the Allies' participation in it growing up, which was this really whitewashed story of we entered into this war for ideological reasons to, you know, save the West from like the hate that was spreading in Germany. We would never throw people into concentration camps. We were the good guys. And the fact that not only was, you know, the Nazi Party inspired in a lot of their systems they set up, you know, by the US, but the fact that all of these things persisted afterward, like you said, really throws that ideological argument into doubt. Like another thing that came to mind just while you were talking about that too was, I think about the Olympics and kind of Hitler's posturing in terms of how he treated race, you know, differently than the US was at the time. I don't know, it's just really striking to think about the narrative we've created for ourselves now about kind of a moral superiority compared to this, as opposed to just how in many ways we have just as deep of roots as fascism as, you know, we're inspiring the National Socialists at the time.
Honestly, I think a real question is if the Nazis had primarily gone east, like if they hadn't touched France or Britain, would the West have intervened at all? You know, I don't know that there would have been an inherent reason for them to if they didn't feel threatened. And again, we've talked a lot at length about how invested they were in opposing and disempowering communism. So I think it's a fair question.
Yeah, I think it's quite easy to imagine an alternative universe in which if Hitler had played his cards differently, he would have been fighting on the same side as Western powers that are now constructed as being somehow diametrically opposed to everything he stood for. But Chuka, you've done such an amazing job of kind of disambiguating that in the context of the US. And I think the US, this is arguably the most important one for us to be looking at, because the US was the main protagonist in the Cold War. And so much of what we're going to be exploring in this show in terms of the Nazis coming to the United States and Canada is kind of rooted, as we've discussed in previous episodes, in the Cold War dynamics. So I think kind of demystifying all this kind of propaganda that's around America is so important. And I think you did an awesome job of that. So thanks again, Chuka. That was really awesome. And I think that was a great discussion. Next week, or next episode, I should say, we're going to be looking at the case of Canada, last but not least. Of course, that's where we're all based. Sarah will be taking the lead on that. Thank you for listening, everyone, and we'll see you in the next episode.